Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for February 8th, 2024. And yes, this week I have 2024 written in my notes. Last week it was kind of interesting. I had 2025 in my show notes. This week I want to talk about some scientific issues in outer space, as always. And I want to talk about the lunar surface. This is something very interesting. We have another spacecraft that, as I speak, is on its way to the moon. Private spacecraft, which will be landing on the moon here shortly, about mid-February. I am told it took off with a Falcon 9 rocket and just a short while ago. And this is the second attempt of a group called Intuitive Machines. They're out of Israel, from what I understand. And their first attempt, I actually was watching in real time because they were part of an XPRIZE, and something I happen to know a little bit about. I've been in XPRIZEs as was a finalist in the Water Abundance XPRIZE, so I'm familiar with the processes, etc. But this was a very interesting one. It was to go to the moon and explore the moon, the lunar surface. And on its way down on the first attempt, a couple of years ago, the everything seemed to fail all at once. And I've talked about this before. I've talked about the NASA lunar surface credibility problem. And so I want to flesh this out a little bit this week, because we've all seen the Apollo footage, which even NASA now concludes or concurs was taken in a studio down in the American Southwest. But they say, oh no, we still went to the moon, but we took the footage down in this warehouse. So anyway, do you believe a self-confirmed liar? Anyway, and so people want to, harass people like me who call into question the lunar landings, the Apollo lunar landings, but there's a lot to be desired there. There's a lot of questions that, you can't answer with the official story. Anyway, but be that as it may, there's this issue of what does the lunar surface really look like? Now, last week, a lander landed on the moon and it came in kind of topsy-turvy. It came in upside down. I believe that was a China, source from China. And they think that they're going to be able to rectify this. And so they have a little rover which turned around and took the picture of the lander. And the lander was upside down. You could see the feet sticking up in the air, and they think they're going to be able to rectify this. But anyway, be that as it may, we got a view of what I believe now is the real lunar surface. And it doesn't look anything like the Apollo lunar surface. The surface of the moon that we see in the Chinese photographs, the recent ones at least, show a lot of really jagged rocks. A really not this smooth living room carpet, quarter inch perfect layer of dust on the surface with a few little undulations or little maybe kind of little soft rises in the, and then some of these craters that are just kind of like very soft in the background. And then, of course, your traditional big boulder there. Kind of like back in the 50s, they occasionally had a black person on TV at the. We called him the token black person. Anyway, that was the token rock in the Apollo lunar landing features. And then they'd have the astronaut chipping away at it, getting back some lunar landing rocks. But anyway, the real surface. Now, let me preface this by saying when NASA built that stage in the American Southwest in warehouses to film the alleged Apollo lunar landing, they did have a pretty good idea of what the lunar surface looked like, but they had a couple issues. They had to drive the lunar rover around this warehouse, and it had to look realistic, and they had to drive that buggy, like 10, 20 miles an hour. They were moving pretty good clip there. And if you had the real lunar surface with jagged rocks and stuff like that, it would have been a pretty bumpy ride at 10, even 5 miles an hour. It would have been an impossible ride. The astronauts would have been flying out left and right. So they had to smooth it out a bit. They had to make it look more like this rolling lunar surface with your living room carpet on it, and then a little bit of a dusting on top of that. And so that's what we saw in the Apollo footage. The real footage of the moon, the real picture, and this is what I've said all along, is you've had volcanic eruptions on the moon, and when it blows the stuff out, imagine, let's say, Mount St. Helens. Let's take a good example. When Mount St. Helens blew, it blew, they were picking up volcanic dust in New York City, little vials of it. I mean, it got that far because it got into the upper stratosphere. It blew it way up there. The same way with that recent one down in, what is it, Java or the down in the South Pacific, and I forget the island that blew up down there. It was an underwater island and it just blew the top off, went up into the stratosphere and circled the whole globe. So that pulverized dust, that just rock that's just blown to smithereens into fine powder, gets up in the atmosphere and it moves. And so imagine on the moon, imagine if Mount St. Helens were on the moon and exploded. That would go all, I mean, that would, because of 1/6 gravity, it would go all over the moon. And these volcanoes have blown off. And back in the say, the Venus days, when Venus was coming by as a large comet, it did a lot of damage to Earth. So it would have done a lot of damage to the moon, caused a lot of volcanic activity. And so the end result is this jagged rock. Now, when I was young, I would have been about 22, 23 years old. I lived in Mexico City. And there's these two volcanoes, Iztaccíhuatl and Popocatépetl, that are out on the eastern, they're out in the plains east of Mexico City. And one day, a group of some of the students from the school and some of the a teacher and some, a few, I don't know who all was in the group, but mainly from the school where I had been teaching, I taught physics and mathematics at that school. That was my first job out of college where I was off on adventures rather than getting back to my graduate studies, which I completed later at Tulane. But anyway, back to Popocatépetl. Early in the morning, everybody took off and went out to climb Popocatépetl. And these people got all the way to the top. I was not in very good physical shape. I mean, I'm okay physical shape, but not to the point where I can climb a 20,000 foot mountain. And of course, Mexico City and the plain there is already, what, 7,000 foot altitude. But still, that meant you had to climb up, what, a good 10,000 feet, which I was not able to do. I actually got altitude sickness part of the way up and kind of got diarrhea on the side of the mountain, and it was pretty, I got sick. I just had to stay there for a while, and then I worked my way back down. But the point of talking about this is Popocatépetl is a cinder cone volcano, much unlike the, say, the South Pacific volcanoes, which are shield volcanoes with lava and smooth rolling lava, which you can walk on, and the moon has some of that too. But when Popocatépetl is a cinder cone volcano, in other words, when it blows, it's an explosive blow. And out of there comes the plume of dust and fine powder and from the steam that's created down below, that's what causes a volcano, unbeknownst to the geological community of the planet. But the side of the cinder cone volcano, Popocatépetl, is covered with this sharp rock, and it's just little pieces. And on the side of Popo, they were like maybe 1 inch diameter and smaller, so not real big rocks. There were some that's maybe 6 inches in diameter, but the vast majority of what covered the side of that mountain, when you get up above, way above the tree line, etc., was just cinder cones, or cinders, I should say, rocks and very sharp, very jagged. And so imagine that you have a volcano on the moon and it blows off. Well, it's going to distribute that all over the moon. Most of it will come out, and if it's in a trajectory, and this is because the gravitational field of the moon is 1/6 that of Earth. So when this stuff comes out at high velocity, it's on its way around the moon, and it's going to cover the whole moon. So you would expect the lunar surface to look like jagged rocks, big, maybe boulder size, and smaller and smaller, down to the point where it's just fine dust covering everything. That's what you would expect the lunar surface to look like, because when these volcanoes go off, the last thing to come down, the big heavy rocks would be in there, and that would set the landscape, and you would have a lot of maybe 6 to 10 inch size rocks, very jagged, very rough, and certainly not something you would drive a little buggy around on. So that's what we're seeing in the new high-resolution photos that came back from China, from the lander that just landed with a little rover and stuff. That's what the lunar surface looks like. But like I say, when NASA did the reproduction in the warehouse down in the American Southwest for the Apollo landing footage, they had to make it a lot smoother, because that lunar buggy just wouldn't be able to drive around on that, on the real lunar surface. Okay, so anyway, and just to be specific, I always have to say this: my official statement on my webpage relative to the Apollo lunar landings is that it is an unverified scientific claim. In spite of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is NASA, you don't get to verify your own scientific claims. And I saw Neil deGrasse Tyson one day on Joe Rogan's show, and he's going, "Oh, we have these photos from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter." Well, no. Number one, they were terrible photographs. Your cell phone could take better pictures. Number two, you don't get to verify your own scientific claims. Sorry, NASA, not even you. So anyway, back to the original story. In a few days, we're going to have new photographs, independent photographs of the lunar surface. Now, I have to add that China landed on the far side of the moon, a scientific first, an achievement first, what was it, a year or two ago, a couple of years ago. And the same thing, they landed, there's the rover, and there's the picture of the rover driving off into the sunset with a completely neutral sky, and so it's mainly looking down at it. In other words, you really couldn't tell anything about the horizon or above the horizon what the sky would look like. And here's this rover, a perfect quarter inch of dust and a perfectly flat living room carpet type of surface. That is not what the lunar surface would look like. So you can imagine over the eons of the lunar surface, I don't care if you believe it's 4.5 billion years old, like the Earth or something, or if you believe what I believe, that it's much more recent and there has been recent activity when large objects come by, like Venus the comet, causing the volcanoes to explode. I don't care what your scenario, the moon doesn't have an atmosphere to weather the rocks. And so the end result would be the same, that there's look at the distribution of particles in the volcanic explosions. The vast majority of it is fine powder. Then as you get up to bigger and bigger sized rocks, up to boulders, there's fewer and fewer. Have you ever been in the spray field of a cinder cone volcano? I have. You can be 20, 40 miles away and find regions where the rocks just came down and just rained down in a certain area. And then you go 10 miles farther and there's none. So it's kind of like a shotgun blast where they come flying out, and these big rocks, the size, oh, not the size of your house, but the size of your automobile or bigger, the size of a semi-trailer truck. And the indigenous people would carve these in place and then stand them up. You'll find these all over the world, situations like this where the indigenous people use this rock, usually relatively soft rock, easily worked, not like the granite that some of the say the artifacts that Egypt are made out of, but a softer rock that's much more pliable, much more workable with just stone implements. But they would carve these and then stand them up where they were found. They didn't move them. Okay, so at any rate, but the idea is that you see the effects on Earth where this kind of like shotgun blast of rocks that size, from the size of your small vehicle, automobile, up to, tractor trailer size, laying around the countryside all over the place, high concentration. Then you go a little bit farther and there's none. And that would be like what the moon would be like. And then, okay, those would be typically the biggest rocks. And then there would be the next level of rocks going down to small bowling ball size. But remember that these are very jagged rocks. Excuse me. And so the idea here is that the lunar surface would be just a compilation of these different sized rocks piled up, and then with a very thin layer, maybe an inch or two, of dust, of this volcanic powder all over the surface. So that's what it would look like. And it would be some kind of a gray color, because that's what volcanic ash looks like on Earth. So we would expect it to look similarly on the moon. But the thing is, you're not gonna have an easy time walking around on this. You're not gonna have an easy time driving a little rover, and certainly not a moon buggy, lunar buggy, or lunar rover, whatever you want to call it, around on this, like a dune buggy type of thing. It's not gonna be, or like that, one of the worst movies ever made by Brad Pitt. Well, a horrible movie. I don't know how he ever bought into that one, but they're driving around the lunar surface on these lunar buggies. And they're not just driving around, they're flying around. They're like 60 miles an hour across the lunar surface. Anyway, the carryover from the back in the Apollo days when they showed this, the lunar rover driving around. And by the way, another thing, I'll go through a number of things, and then I'm going to compare this to Mars. But a lot of people think, well, what is Mars like? What's the comparison? But the other issue with the lunar dust is that it's highly electrical. And so, when you take the old high school laboratory experiments, you take a plastic rod and you rub it with a wool piece of wool or something like that, and you create electricity. Static electricity, there's different ways to create static electricity. And on the moon, you have many, many electrical situations going on. It's discharging the solar capacitor. There's a surface potential. There's a small vertical electric field at the ground. And the astronauts are going to have a lot of trouble with dust. Well, also on Mars, dust is going to be a big issue. But on the moon, it's like static electric charged, and it would just cover every it would be all over everything. The Hasselblad cameras, the moon suits, they would have come back. And that's one of the odd things too, is that when the Apollo astronauts walked out of the space capsule after they recovered it, it looked like they just got done shopping at Macy's. They were bright spanking clean, and that's not the way you would look. If you came back from the moon, you would be covered with stuff, and that's another indication. And that's one of the kind of comical things about the Mars rovers up there, that every now and then they get completely covered in a dust storm, and then all of a sudden they're cleaned off like they just went to a car wash. So anyway, don't get me started on this stuff. But back to the moon and the real moon surface. We have seen a glimpse of the real lunar surface, and like I say, you can just kind of estimate what it would be like, because when these volcanoes go off, the cinder cone types of volcanoes that the moon does have, it would just blow this stuff all over the place. And so the lunar surface would be covered with that thin layer of dust, not so thin actually, but then underneath it you would have these volcanic cinder cone type of rocks, because when it comes out of the cinder cones on the moon, it's coming out with steam, with gaseous steam. There would be the same explosive situation as on planet Earth, where you have water down there, it turns to steam, and you basically have a steam engine where it just comes blasting out of the ground. That's what causes a volcano, is the water that's in the ground, the water table slides down into the magma, turns to steam, and you've got yourself a volcano. And of course, standard geology doesn't understand that. But anyway, back to the real lunar surface. Now, coming up in a few days, I think it's actually a week from today. I think it's going to be on the 15th of February. So maybe we'll get a view of this before next week's show. But there's going to be this company, Intuitive Machines, it is called, their second attempt to land on the lunar surface. So we'll see if they get sabotaged. And I talked about this, maybe was it last week or 2 weeks ago, where these private enterprise moon landings have never succeeded. You know, we have the China ones, we have the U.S., we have, of course, the Russian ones. And back in the 90s, I was working with Russian scientists at the University of Novosibirsk. They were atmospheric scientists, very excellent, and they were physicists. So it was not just atmospheric scientists. They were dealing with the atmosphere of the sun. And they're the ones that verified my atmospheric fusion model of the sun with a very interesting experiment. These guys were really good. But they all, under their breath, would tell you that, no, they had been to the moon many times, of course, since the Apollo landings, and they had never seen anything. And that would be a perfect third-party verification. But you have to understand, in the modern world, the Russian scientists are, you know, under the skin of NASA, because they get a lot of funding, up until at least the Ukraine war. They had a lot of connection to the U.S. space program, because Russia was doing all our launching. We had no launch capability before Elon Musk. And SpaceX, we had zero launch capability, and that included military launches, which the Russians were sending up into space. And the Russians did the majority of hauling for the International Space Station. It was not the United States, because our shuttle program was pretty much, in historical terms, a disaster. You know, not even mentioning a couple accidents which cost human life. But just the fact that we had no capability of getting stuff into space. So anyway, very interesting next week, and I'll definitely be looking at that. I have a follow-up story next week about the private company lunar landing and the surface of the moon, what it looks like. And that's what they don't want. They don't want people to see, because there are parts of the lunar surface that are much newer and possibly with exposed terrain from some of the volcanism, etc. Okay, so we'll see about that. Oh, and I forgot to mention Mars, comparing this to Mars. And remember that when NASA did the filming of the Apollo down in that warehouse down in the American Southwest, They had an idea. They had a pretty good idea of what the lunar surface was like, which tells us that they had lunar landers, and of course they did, landing on the moon. The Russians had already brought back lunar rocks, but of course it had nothing to do with the moon. That's the thing. And that's like people picking up rocks on planet Earth and saying, oh, it's 4.5 billion years old, that's the age of the Earth. Whatever you find on the surface of the Earth has absolutely nothing to do with the origins of Earth or the history of the Earth. Anything original down deep in the core would be, I like the Elon Musk statement that the Earth is basically a big ball of lava with a very thin crust. That's a great example, because anything original down there is just molten, and there's no semblance of anything original. So there's no way to measure or estimate or pick up a rock and test it for something and decide the age of the Earth. The Earth could be 100 billion years old. We don't know. It could be 1 billion years old. It's, 4.5 billion years that NASA talks about in the standard scientific community. That's just fairy tale. There's no way of knowing that. Or they also take stuff in space, stuff that falls into the atmosphere, and they measure that. They do some hocus pocus and come up with 4.5 billion years, and they go, oh, that's commensurate with the age of the Earth. It's all hocus pocus science. It has no validity whatsoever. But let's jump off to Mars. Now, Mars is a different animal. It's bigger than the moon. It's more like a terrestrial planet. The moon is just a little bit smaller. But the issue with Mars, it has an atmosphere. And not just any atmosphere. It gets pretty wild there. You've got the tornadoes, the cyclonic tornado-type wind structures there that get the sand blowing there up to 300 miles an hour. So this is like a level 7, F7 tornado, or level 8 maybe. And sandblasting is one of the most effective ways of just doing in geological features. And that's one of the bizarre things about Mars, which I've already talked about. I have a whole section of this on my webpage dealing with the surface of Mars. It's in the center fold of my Principia Meteorologia, the physics of Sun-Earth weather. I talk about the weather of the planets, and I talk specifically about Mars and the from satellite orbiting satellite photographs of Mars. And you see all of the water, the river channels, the delicate little river channels that are unbroken in on the highlands. And Mars is a lot like Earth, where you have the highlands on one's kind of egg-shaped. So you have the highlands on kind of one side of the planet and the lowlands on the other. And you see that the lowlands, where the water was before the Venus passage, where the Venus took the atmosphere and oceans off of Mars, Mars was a blue planet less than 10,000 years ago. And this Venus passing by robbed it of its atmosphere and oceans. The ancients talk about that. But the point is that all of this, these geological features are recent. And in the lowlands, there is no cratering at all. All of the cratering, where these are impact craters, not volcanic craters, but impact craters, they're in the highlands. What does that tell you? That the surface of Mars is very recent, or very recently has changed. And the lowlands, the reason there's no impact craters, there are very few, is because when the impacts came in, they were neutralized by the water, and they didn't create an impact crater. The energy was absorbed by the water, and there was probably a pretty good splash, but the it did not, and then the water, the action of the water, etc., would have basically eliminated any semblance of cratering that may have occurred if anything got deep enough to actually form a crater. But a lot of the impact energy was taken up by the water itself in the oceans of Mars. And so the highlands are heavily cratered, which tells us also that this is very recent. And if you take away even the story of Venus coming by, which the Velikovsky talks about that, about the all of the ancient civilizations saw Mars as a blue planet. Okay, but now without the atmosphere, without the water, that was basically sucked off into the comet Venus. Venus was a larger celestial object than Mars, and so when the electrical connection occurred, the comet nucleus Venus 1 and basically withdrew the ocean and atmosphere from Mars, but leaving it the dry hulk that we see today. When you see the rover pictures of Mars, all you see are actions of wind and water. You see sedimentary rock. You see channels that are carved from water erosion. I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting once. This was one I used to attend regularly. I don't go anymore because it's pretty worthless. The people there have no clue what's going on, so it's like a waste of time and money to go there. But these geologists were sitting in a room. I walked in, I was waiting for a lecture, and they were in there. It was going to be dealing with the surface features of Mars from one of the new, I think from one of the rovers. And they had very close-up images, and they were looking at them. And they knew who I was, and I made a few comments, and they were like, under their breath, they would admit that Mars had recent water erosion, meaning serious amounts of water on Mars recently, but they couldn't say it publicly. When the meeting started, they were all mum as church mouse, quiet as church mouse, because they couldn't give their opinion of what really their opinion was of Mars. And they were showing pictures of the water erosion, like spillways and things like that, where very definitely any geologist would recognize these, and they did, but they couldn't talk about it because the official story of NASA was that this all happened billions of years ago. But the moon and Mars are very different animals when it comes to being on the surface, because the moon has no erosion, and all of this stuff that's accumulated, especially these volcanic rocks, which are in. Oh, let's just say, like cinder cone. Cinder is very rough on the surface. You could take it and very abrasive. And that's what would be underneath the thin layer of dust that's around the moon, the volcanic dust. But like I say, you could not drive a lunar buggy around on this. It just wouldn't work. So that's. Anyway, enough said. We'll talk about this again next week. I'll be very anxiously awaiting the landing of this Intuitive Machines lander this coming week. I want a quick talk about the irreparable damage being done by CO2 removal. Now, there's already companies beginning this activity of removing CO2 from the atmosphere, sequestering it, it's called. Sequestering means you don't only remove it, but you keep it removed from the atmosphere. We actually need a lot more CO2 in the atmosphere. And I talked about being a on the in the X Prize, the Elon Musk X Prize. He gave $400 million, the biggest X Prize to that date. And to develop teams that would then sequester CO2 from the atmosphere. And what I wanted to do is to see if it was possible. And I came up with a mechanism myself. And I have dropped out of that competition because I just don't want any part of removing CO2 from the atmosphere. We should not be burning coal and oil and even natural gas. We should be using a limited amount. We should be getting our energy from the wind, which goes directly into energy without a great amount of heat loss. Solar is terrible. 80% of the sun that hits the solar panel goes off into the atmosphere as heat, kills birds, kills the plants around there. They're just an environmental disaster, not to mention the leaching of the chemicals that are in the solar panels into the ground. Horrific chemicals that are polluting the ground around these solar installations. So, but the idea that you should remove CO2 from the atmosphere and get us back to the 1980s, okay, but are they going to stop there? That's the problem. And we really need a lot more CO2 in the atmosphere for plant growth. If we had a lot more plant growth, which would happen if we had more CO2, there are people who have done studies that if we go below a certain level of CO2 in the atmosphere, all the plant life will die. They're right now stretched. Imagine that if the human race had 0.04% of the atmosphere oxygen, there wouldn't be a human race. We'd be competing with the ground worms or fish for oxygen. And so that's the situation. We really need a lot more CO2 in the atmosphere. And when the dinosaurs were here, when the woolly mammoths were here, I guarantee you the atmosphere had huge amounts of CO2 to support that plant life. And then you could have those big animals, because can you imagine what a dinosaur, the dino dinosaurs, the great big ones, the vegetarian dinosaurs, immense animals, what they ate in a day. There's no place on planet Earth right now that would support even one for a day. They would eat so much, and this was growing like crazy, the fern forests, etc. I mean, to produce enough foliage for these animals to consume in a day, and they weren't the only ones. They weren't the only animals out there foraging for greens, etc., the part of the food chain. And of course, you had the carnivores, the rexes, that were out there eating the dinosaurs that were feeding, the food chains, eating the vegetation. So the T. rexes eating the plant-eating dinosaurs who were eating the plants, who were feeding off the carbon dioxide atmosphere, very thick carbon dioxide atmosphere. And the Earth was a lot warmer at that time because the Earth typically should be relatively warm. We have come out of glaciation. That's why the Earth is warming up. It's not because you're driving your SUV up and down the road. But like I say, people would hear me say, oh, that we can't take CO2 out of the atmosphere. No. And actually, the atmosphere needs more CO2 to pros for the plants to prosper and grow, so we have better growth. But I'm not saying that we should burn a lot more coal, etc., to achieve that extra CO2. But let the planet be as it is, because once man starts playing God and starts changing things, then other things are going to happen. We don't know all the reverberations that are going to happen by removing CO2 from the atmosphere. But what I will tell you is that the method I developed could extract large amounts, sequester, not just remove CO2, but sequester CO2, large volumes of CO2 from the atmosphere, to the point where it would literally use it all up. And then there's the point of no return, where the plants would stop growing, and then the life cycle would change, because all basically animals that breathe oxygen depend on that cycle. They eat from that food chain that originates from CO2 supported plant life. Just as simple as that. But the point is, as I said, there are methods to reduce greatly the CO2 in the atmosphere. And that's really a bad thing. So that is irreparable damage done by CO2 removal, and that's why that has to be stopped. The people like Musk, who creates the prize, well-intentioned, and I've seen him in videos, the original when they first came out with the prize. There's a video of him talking with Peter Diamandis of the XPRIZE on why they need this. And I mean, the XPRIZE internally is very, very woke, let's put it that way. And that's fine. But the science, here's the problem. The science of CO2 is very bad science. And the reason is that CO2 is not a greenhouse. It is the difference between a greenhouse and CO2 is there's no glass ceiling. In a greenhouse, the reason it warms up is because you have a glass ceiling, and that keeps the air from rising. So it keeps the heat down. You don't have that with CO2. The heat that's generated, and I've always said this too, is that the heat that's generated in any combustible process, where you're burning oxygen, whether it's a coal-fired nuclear power plant or a coal-fired power plant, whether it's automobiles or trucks or diesel or gasoline or natural gas, heating your home in the wintertime or whatever it is, it's using the Carnot cycle, which simply means that about 75% of that energy, about 75% after you consider all of the losses, theoretically about 33% of the energy is actually goes towards useful work, and the other 70%, or in reality, it's about 25% efficiency when you're using a Carnot cycle, because like with an automobile engine, it has to do many other things. It has to charge the battery. It has to run the lights. It has to overcome the friction of the engine, all of these other things, you know, run the transmission. All of these things take energy. So you're not 100% efficient on any of this, running some kind of gasoline or diesel engine, wind resistance of the car. You have to subtract all of these energy losses from the initial Carnot cycle, ideal, you know, 32%, whatever it is. And so that gets you down to around 25%. So about 75% of the energy that you burn goes directly into the atmosphere. What happens with that heat? It's a lot greater than any greenhouse effect could ever be. And that's why the whole concept of greenhouse effect doesn't work. I've given entire lectures on this topic, going after point after point after point, that the whole the science behind greenhouse, the global greenhouse, climate change, and all of that is complete garbage science. Makes no sense at all. But here's the crux of it also. Ask yourself a very simple question. Has the last 20 or 30 years of global climate fanaticism done anything? No, absolutely not. We're using far more energy today than ever before. This in terms of burning coal, burning natural gas, burning diesel, burning gasoline. We're burning more today than ever before. So the whole climate thing is a failure. It hasn't worked. And why? Because it's a peripheral issue. And people don't buy into peripheral issues. They see their kids eating food on the table and having a warm house as being much more important than your peripheral greenhouse issue that's going to happen in 50 years. And by now, we should have been seeing the effects of ocean level rising, etc. It's not happening. You know, people look at, oh, Venice, it's the sea level is rising. No. Venice has been dropping for a long, long time. Let's just put it that way. And so that's not sea level rise. But the reality is that we should have seen, you know, parts of New York City are already underwater. And last time I looked, it is not. So the bottom line here is, yes, there's danger if we have melting of the certain major ice caps, Antarctica, Greenland especially. But the world is warming up. When I was a kid, the great glaciers were still there out in Montana, and the western states still had glaciers. They're gone in my lifetime. And that's because the Earth is warming up. The Earth is warming up because we were in an ice age. Why were we in an ice age? Because the Earth passed through the tail of a large comet and absorbed a lot of moisture, and it froze and it made glaciers. And so it took a long time for those glaciers to start. I talk about this in my weather book. The low, slow recovery initially, and then the accelerated recovery with time. And so now the glaciers are disappearing at an accelerated rate, yes, because we, as an Earth, we're getting back to normal. We're not heating up beyond what is normal. We're getting back to normal. So that's the bottom line on that. And of course, the problem here is that you have people that want to go out and start removing CO2 from the atmosphere. It's not a good idea. And for them to unilaterally do this, and this is part of the problem, is for people to unilaterally decide that they're right and they're going to go remove CO2 from the atmosphere is a bad situation. What if I decided one day that I didn't like that mountain over there? I'm just going to go remove it because it's my opinion that mountain should not be there. So I'm going to go do that. That's the same type of logic, that somebody decides they're going to go make major changes to the Earth's ecosystem, and then they go do it. And you might say, well, you know, the people decided to burn fuel and create this situation of excess CO2. But the bottom line is 0.04% of the world's atmosphere is CO2. 20% of the world's atmosphere is oxygen. And the critical situation for plants is that lower than about half of that amount of CO2, the plants will simply not be able to survive, and the entire planet will die. So measure that against sea level rising, which has not happened. It should have been already happening if what they're saying is true. But the summary point here is that there will be irreparable damage done by CO2 sequestration from the atmosphere. It should not be done. Leave it the way it is. Everything is fine. We're not all going to die. And the other issue with CO2 and the global climate warming scenario, which they've stopped talking about, they call it climate change, not climate warming, is that and I explain it this way. Take two cardboard boxes, put them on a desk, completely sealed. Or if you really want to get fancy, if you're in a government laboratory, then you would make your boxes out of stainless steel. But two boxes exactly the same. Okay. And they have inside of them the exact same atmosphere at the exact same temperature. Now, using thermodynamics, calculate the amount of heat energy. Energy, heat is an energy dimension, and so in physics. And so determine the amount of energy in that box. And if you did that correctly, they're the same temperature, etc., you would get the exact same amount of energy in the box. The velocity of the molecules, the distribution of velocities, the masses of the molecules that are in the boxes, the whole nine yards. Okay, now let's pretend that in your boxes, stainless steel if you're government funded, cardboard if you're like me, because I wouldn't have the funding to buy stainless steel containers. But the end result is the same. Okay, so now on one of the boxes, put water vapor at the same temperature as the gas that's in your stainless steel containers. The temperature is the same. This is the point. The temperature is the same, but the box with the water vapor now has more energy in it. So the heat content is higher in the one with water. Now, let's raise the temperature a bit in the box that does not have the water vapor. Let's raise the temperature. The temperature is higher, but the total amount of energy is less than the box that has the water vapor. Okay? So the point is that temperature is not a measurement of heat content. And this is the big, big fallacious error dealing with climate theory, or whatever you want to call it, is that temperature is remotely related to heat content, but it's a very distant relative. And so what you should be measuring as a scientist is not the temperature. That's the easy thing to do. That's the lazy thing to do. You got a scientist in a university building in his nice cush office, sticks his thermometer out the window, and he goes, it's warmer today, therefore global warming. It has nothing to do with global warming. You would have to go around the world and have almost an infinite number of data points where you would not only measure the temperature, but the composition of the material in the atmosphere, in the water, whatever you are measuring, and then make a determination of heat content. So the question is the heat content of the world rising because of CO2 in the atmosphere? And the answer is no. Very simple, no. So CO2 is not contributing to the overall heat of the planet. What is contributing to the heat of the planet, which is lost every night when the Earth turns around and it's nighttime, all that heat that's generated directly, 75% of it from all the burning of fossil fuels, which is a misnomer, you know, coal, gasoline, diesel, natural gas, 75% of that energy going directly into the atmosphere, and that gets expunged from the atmosphere every day. Every day. So you don't have to wait 50 years, and it's, I always liken it to, take a big sledgehammer. Say you have a nail, okay, that you're trying to pound into a board. And you got a great big sledgehammer, and you got a little teeny jeweler's mallet. The global warming heating is like the little teeny jeweler's mallet, and the direct heating of the atmosphere from burning fuel is the sledgehammer. And you're going to tell me that you're more worried about the little jeweler's hammer than you are about the big sledgehammer. That's what global climate people are telling you. Bad science from beginning to end, top to bottom. It doesn't make any sense. It has no scientific validity at all, yet it's running the planet. And now they want to remove it, and it's the thing that plants need to grow with. No, it's a irresponsible, damaging process to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. We actually need more CO2. But driving up your SUV up and down the road is not the way to get that. And like I say, now just understand the demise of the dinosaurs, the demise of the mastodons, both were caused by large passing comets, which altered the atmospheric content of planet Earth. During those epochs, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere was much higher, allowing abundant plant growth and allowing absolutely abundant animal growth as a result of that, because there was such an abundance of food that allowed the food chain, the people who consumed the plants, etc., and that whole food chain to prosper with vast numbers. Probably, I would make an estimate that potentially during the dinosaurs, we could have had maybe instead of 0.04% carbon dioxide, maybe let's put 100 times that, 4% atmosphere of CO2, and just absolute abundant plant growth, which prospered all of the animal life living in the oceans, in the atmosphere, etc. Okay, as long as I'm on the tack of talking about bad scientific ideas, here's one that takes the cake. Now, there's been similar proposals dealing with going vertically through the atmosphere. One of them is the space elevator, a ridiculous idea that will not work because it doesn't understand that the majority of energy is not getting vertically up into space, but horizontally. When you're inserting into orbit, you have to put most of your energy not in getting up, but in getting going sideways at orbital velocities. So the space elevator simply won't work. Another one is to collect energy from the sun with big collectors, concentrate them on electrical generators in outer space, and then beam the energy down through using microwaves to receptors that would be down on the surface of the Earth. A tremendously bad idea. Now, both of these would cause a discharge of the vertical electric field of Earth. When now that's becoming more common, space launches, some of them are early dawn, some of them are at night, they're starting to see the discharges of the upper atmosphere. As these things penetrate the upper atmosphere, they're starting to see the discharges in traces. The discharges actually illuminate the atmosphere, kind of like a neon bulb. And you can see this, and people are actually photographing it. So if you start messing around, and that's just this little 300-foot rocket with a little exhaust plume. If you start breaking down the vertical electric field, you're going to have major league discharges. And that's what happened with some of Tesla's experiments, like at Colorado Springs, and also the Northeast power outage, where the U.S. up in facility up in Canada, west of Ottawa, was experimenting with a Tesla tower and discharged the vertical electric field, which caused that whole northeast sector blackout and backed up 9 nuclear power plants. That's how powerful that surge was. And so you don't want to do anything with the vertical electric field. That's why I stopped working on my Tesla project to garner atmospheric the discharge of the vertical electric field for energy. It's a bad idea. But now somebody is proposing that they collect energy with reflectors, and those would then beam down raw sunlight down to solar panels on the surface of the Earth. But then when you look into it, they would only provide about another 10 to 15 minutes worth of sunlight on these regions of down on planet Earth, on the surface of the Earth. So an absolutely ridiculous payback, ridiculously small payback for a tremendous amount of expense and logistics. Okay, so a quick announcement here on the JAMCC water filters. And there is a sale going on. Just thought you might like to know about this. There's a 20% discount, Valentine's Day sale. And if you use the coupon code Valentine, just like the Valentine's Day, Valentine, and you would get a 20% discount off the already discounted prices there. This is mainly for the MR5 whole house water filter and the best deal. The best deal is the MR5 whole house water filter, the UV sterilizer, which is the biggest, best one in the industry, and then the extra pack of filter elements for the MR5. So that's on sale. So it's normally $23.80. Right now it's on sale for $400 off for $19.80, and you get an additional 20% off Valentine coupon code from that, which brings it around down to around $15.80. A very good deal. And then, of course, you get a plumber to install it. We work with your plumbers. We don't recommend plumbers because every area is different. The code is different. All of the, installation, the type, some people might have it outside, some people might have it inside or in their garage. That all depends on your location, and your local plumber would be the best person to know all of those details. But when it comes down to specifics, we help them install the MR5. We give them, answer their questions. And then also the replacement filter elements for the, what do people commonly call the Berkey, the gravity water filters. Those are on the webpage. And you can get a 5% discount code using the coupon code JMCC. But the Valentine is the coupon code for the big stuff, over $400 minimum order. And this is, once again, the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.